So, let us continue where we left off yesterday. So yesterday we had a look at the sutta called volition or will. And now we're going to move on to the next sutta, which is called the Singsapa Grove, is the name of this particular sutta. And the idea again here is just to give a little bit of background information, if you like, to look at kind of the bigger picture, the bird's eye view of the Dhamma before we kind of move on to the gradual training and the Noble Eightfold Path and all the practical application of these teachings. So again, it's just taking a step back, getting the overall view of things before we look at the details. And this is one of those suttas that is very simple, but actually it gives a nice entry point to the Four Noble Truths that we're going to have a look at next. So this is how it goes. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in a Singsapa grove. Then the Blessed One took up a few Singsapa leaves in his hand and addressed the monks thus, "What do you think, bhikkhus, which is more numerous, these few leaves that I have taken up in my hand, or those in the grove overhead?" So it's a pretty obvious question, right? So all the leaves overhead and the kind of the leaf that it takes up in his hand. So it's pretty much like a rhetorical question, I suppose. "Venerable sir, the leaves that the Blessed One has taken up in his hand are few, but those in the grove overhead are numerous, sir. So too, bhikkhus, the things I have directly known but have not taught you are numerous, while the things I have taught you are few. And why, bhikkhus, have I not taught those many things? Because they are unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. They do not lead to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment or awakening, to Nibbana. Therefore, I have not taught them. And what, bhikkhus, have I taught? I have taught this is suffering. I have taught this is the origin of suffering. I have taught this is the cessation of suffering. I have taught this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And why, bhikkhus, have I taught this? Because this is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, and it leads to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to Nibbana. This, therefore, I have taught this." The Buddha, he makes a distinction between, if you like, all of the things that he has realized. What he's saying here is that I've realized all of these other things. When he says, I have directly known, this means I have insight. Directly known is a Pali word called abhinya. And abhinya really means insight. I have insight into all of these things. But I have not taught these things. So what I have insight into is vast. But what I have taught you is very small. And again, of course, the important distinction here is what is pragmatic, what is practical, what actually is useful with the problem at hand. There is a problem right here at hand, and that is a problem of suffering, the problem of existence, if you like. How are we going to deal with that? And that is really what the Buddha's path is all about. And then there are all these other things which may be very exciting, right? When you see the Buddha says, "I have known all of these other things." What do you think when you hear that? Do you think it would be cool to know about those things? It's like, yeah, let's see those other things, right? This is kind of interesting. That's what I think when I hear that. What about, you know, you can have a kind of alternative to Pitaka with all the kind of, you know, all these other points. So it is interesting, and this is precisely the problem. Yeah, these are things that do not actually lead to awakening. Yeah? These are things that are more, I would say, this is kind of what is the possibly like philosophy or natural philosophy, understanding of the nature of the world. But they don't really have any bearing on you know, our practice of the spiritual path. And yet they are exciting. You think about it, yeah, I would be interested in knowing about this. Just as it is interesting to read about the latest breakthroughs in science and these kind of things, in exactly the same way. But it doesn't really work. So what are these things that the Buddha hasn't taught? And as I just said just now, I think mainly what they are matters of philosophy, matters of describing the world, seeing the world in the right way, maybe things that are similar to what we now would call science, right, and that sort of thing. That is probably what a lot of these things are about. And interesting, but kind of irrelevant for the path. What is, of course, interesting, if you look at Buddhist history here, after the Buddha passed away, all of these things that the Buddha did not teach, the monks and maybe the nuns and maybe the lay people as well, they started to speculate about these things. As soon as the Buddha passed away, they started looking at all those other leaves. There's so many leaves here. How interesting. Let's check them out. And they forgot that the Buddha didn't teach these things for a reason. And then, of course, not long after the Buddha passed away, you start to get the Abhidhamma arising. And the Abhidhamma, what is that? It is philosophy. Abhidhamma is all about how to divide the world into discrete entities, into, you know, how everything can be kind of cataloged and categorized according to certain states and certain, certain ways of looking at the mind and the body. And we want to have the whole experience, everything we can experience, to be cataloged in this way, everything broken down into the most minute and consistent entities that don't change over time. And this is that's exactly what the Abhidhamma project is all about. The Dhamma Sangani literally means the enumeration of Dhamma. Sangani is enumeration of counting. And Dhamma is like the constituent blocks of reality. So enumeration of the constituent blocks of reality, that's what it is all about. So it's philosophy. It's describing the world, just like science tries to describe the world. Then you have the other parts of the Abhidhamma, which is like the Patthana, which is how to interrelate all of these various constituent blocks, how they actually relate to each other, how one arrives as a consequence of the other ones, what kind of causality, what kind of conditioning actually these things work under. So that's what the Abhidhamma is all about. It is precisely, I think in a large part, it is the kind of filling in those gaps that the Buddha actually left on purpose. Because the Buddha realized if we get into this kind of thing, there's no end to that. There's no end to arguing and discussing and talking about the issues of reality. And that's, of course, exactly what you see in the Abhidhamma. As soon as the Abhidhamma arises, they start to argue about it. They argue much more about that than they argue about the sutta sometimes. And that's why you get the divergence into different schools. If you look at the suttas in the different schools of Buddhism, actually they're very similar. You look at the Sarvastivadin school, which is now found in Chinese to a large extent. You find some of the suttas that belong to different schools, the Dhammaguptakas, and there are scattered suttas from various schools of Buddhism. And actually, it's pretty much exactly the same, because this was the word of the Buddha. It was considered sacrosanct. You can't change the word of the Buddha. You've got to keep it, right? And it makes sense. But where the arguments really started to arise was in the area of Abhidhamma. And when you look at the Abhidhamma of the various schools, they had long discussions, long kind of going on forever. And these Abhidhammas eventually had split off and went in different directions. And they are quite different as a consequence. So this is one of the reasons I think that we should not really pay too much attention to the Abhidhamma as Buddhist practitioners. So we should go back to the word of the Buddha, what the Buddha was talking about. We should be practical and pragmatic and do those things that lead to awakening rather than getting bogged down in philosophy. Our minds are such that we tend to enjoy that. We enjoy good discussions about things, right, and having good discussion about the nature of reality and what is true and what isn't. It's very exciting, and especially if you have kind of a certain ability in that area. It's kind of fun to kind of take part in such discussions and sort out the problems and all these kind of things. But it's just the mind is naturally restless, and the mind is naturally restless, wants to indulge in those things that kind of give gratification to a restless mind. And that is what is happening here, I think. So remember that. It's a very simple simile, right? Focus on the essentials, is what the Buddha says. Focus on those things that actually really matter. It's hard enough already. Even as a monastic sometimes, you read all the suttas and you're trying to keep on top of the kind of the latest comparative studies, you know, Analayo, he brings out one new article, comparative study every week or so, you know. He's this scholar of comparative study of the suttas, and very prolific. He kind of, you know, one study after the other one, but very interesting, a lot of that. But that is already enough if you're not going to also delve into other aspects that actually are irrelevant to the path really here. So focus on the essentials, I think, is so important in Buddhism. Otherwise, you get sidetracked before you take your last breath. And that's it, finished, you had your chance. You didn't use it properly, and now that's tough luck. So this is what this is about. So what is the teaching then? How does the Buddha summarize this kind of pragmatic teaching? And you see it right here. It's summarized as the Four Noble Truths. Yeah. Why? Because these are, it says here, they are beneficial. In other words, they lead to something positive, right? They lead to a reduction in problems and an improvement in your well-being, and they are relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. That is the Adi Brahmacharyaka, is the Pali for that. And in other words, they are relevant to all of the things that we have to do on the path, yeah, to reach awakening. And then it leads to all of these things. And these things, the long list you have here, these are all the results of the practice. Yeah, revulsion. The Pali word is Nibbida. And the idea of revulsion here is really the idea that when you see things according to reality, when you see dukkha in its fullest extent, your mind turns away from that. Yeah, it's like anything, when you see something unpleasant in the world, you don't want to keep your focus on that, so your mind turns away from those things that are unpleasant. So revulsion, you can call it repulsion if you like it. You can call it perhaps aversion. It's not ill will, it's not a state of mind which is defiled. It's just, oh, I can't bear look at it anymore. It's too much. It's like when you see somebody in a very, dire situation, somebody who's very, very ill, and they look completely amazed, they look terrible. And sometimes you just can't bear looking at it because it just looks so, it's just painful to look at, basically. And so you turn away. Not because you have ill will, not because you have any negativity towards it. It's just too much, too unbearable to look at these things. One of the similes that I often use is that, you know, if you have imagine you have a hot plate in your house, right? Like most of you have a cooktop where you cook your meals, and a hot plate there. And sometimes somebody has turned on that hot plate. You're not aware that it has been turned on. And then by accident you put your hand on the hot plate. If you put your hand on the hot plate by accident when it's really, really hot, right? 200 degrees or even more perhaps, you don't have to think, oh, should I take it away or should I not, right? If you think like that, you have a big problem. If you put your hand on the hot plate, it's automatic. You just withdraw it straight away. You don't have to think about it for a fraction of a second. It's an automatic reaction. And this is exactly the idea in Buddhism. It's the idea that when you see suffering and you see it fully and you see it properly, there's an automatic turning away by the mind. And you look in a different direction because you can't bear it anymore. It's just too unpleasant. And this is the idea of revulsion. I know it's interesting, the story behind this, because a lot of these translations that you see here, they are the input from various people. Yeah, so people have, Bhikkhu Bodhi said, well, this is my translation, would you like to give some input in this translation? And this particular word, revulsion, this is actually Ajahn Brahm's suggestion. Yeah, I know the inside story behind this, right? This is kind of interesting. So Ajahn Brahm said, it doesn't mean disenchantment. Disenchantment is kind of the standard translation for this word. It doesn't mean that. It's much more powerful. Yeah, it's actually the mind moving powerfully away from these things. And then Bhikkhu Bodhi used that because it is a good argument. There are some very good passages in the suttas that support the idea that this is much more powerful emotional feeling than just disenchantment. Disenchantment just means, yeah, you're not interested anymore, you know, that's kind of boring or whatever, and that's kind of disenchantment. So, but it's actually much more than that. So he put that in there for good reasons, because there's good support in other suttas. But then there were people complaining. Especially, I don't know if anybody, you know, what you think about this translation, maybe you also would like to complain because it sounds too challenging, right? Revulsion. But people complained. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, he of course lives in America, so most of the people who complained were presumably American. And they said, oh, it's too much, you know, I revulsion, it just really puts me off the sutras. I don't want to read the sutras anymore when I see this kind of strong terminology in there. It really kind of puts me off the whole beautiful Dhamma. And then he returned in the his latest translation, the Anguttara Nikaya, he returned to use this enchantment again because of all those complaints that he was getting from people. Yeah, I can't deal with it. It's just too much. But to me, that is the wrong way of going about translation work, because the idea is here we have these fabulous teachings from the Buddha. He used these terms, yeah. And if he used them because he wants to present the Dhamma as it is, we can't really pretend that the Dhamma is one way if it is something else. We have to teach the Dhamma as it is. Otherwise, if we water it down, we end up losing the kind of main points of what the Dhamma is all about. So I think that is kind of unfortunate that when we, yes, we take on board criticism, okay, we can take it on board in certain areas, but we shouldn't take it on board in such a way that we water down the Dhamma and we end up diluting the whole message. And after a while, people just don't get it anymore. Yeah, after a while, they don't understand because it's so diluted. You think, yeah, okay, whatever, and you kind of carry on and you have no idea what it actually means. So it is so important that we, in my opinion anyway, that we present the Dhamma actually for what it is. If some people get turned off by that, so be it. Right? There are other people who will benefit from that because they will say, yeah, this makes sense. Now I understand it. And they will have profound insights as a consequence. And you end up destroying the potential for insight if you use the lowest common denominator to decide how to translate the suttas. Anyway, I'm getting really carried away now, so I'm going to be here a long time. So these are words that are all about the end, where the path is going. Yeah. So revulsion is the nibbida, dispassion. This is viraga. So dispassion just means the opposite of craving. You're giving up craving. This is kind of what dispassion is about. Cessation. This is again a very similar thing. It refers really to the cessation of craving itself. Craving comes to an end. To peace. Upasamaha. When you have no craving, you feel peaceful. There's nothing driving you anymore, not going anywhere. You feel peaceful. Direct knowledge, avinya. This is the thing I said just before. It's nice to translate as insight, because that is really what it refers to. And then we have sambodhi, enlightenment here, sambodha, which means like awakening. Yeah, seeing things. I think in some European languages or some Indo-European languages, I think in Russian they still use the word Buddha. Buddha means awake, I think. Yeah. So it actually has that root meaning of being awake. Yeah. And then the last one is Nibbana. Nibbana, which really means something like extinguishment in the suttas. That something is extinguished, right? Like the flame going out and all of these kind of things. And I think it is important to translate words like Nibbana properly, because at the time of the Buddha, the word Nibbana had a meaning. Yeah, it meant something to those people. And what it meant was precisely extinguishment, something going out. And especially, of course, in the suttas, it refers to the extinguishment of the defilements. The defilements going out, and when the defilements go out, the kind of the inner fire, the agi of greed, hatred, and delusion is extinguished as a consequence. And I think it is important to translate, because if you don't translate, then you read anything into the word Nibbana. Oh, Nibbana is this mysterious thing, this mysterious state. Actually, it's not all that mysterious at all. It just means extinguishment. How mysterious is extinguishment? Yeah, not very mysterious. The flame goes out, bang, it, extinguishment. There you have it. Much better. Otherwise, you tend to get sidetracked by all kind of philosophizing and thinking about, oh, Nibbana, what an amazing state, and all this kind of stuff. Not really all that amazing state, extinguishment, that's all it is. So there you are. That's what I say anyway. Of course, you are allowed to doubt whatever I say, but that's my take on that. And then we have, of course, so that is then the Four Noble Truths. They actually lead to all of these things. So if you understand the Four Noble Truths correctly, and you practice in accordance with that, it leads to all of these things. So if you are keen on getting extinguished, then you need to understand the Four Noble Truths. So are you ready to get extinguished? Everyone happy with that? Yeah? Okay, good. Let's see. That's kind of the foundation here. So, therefore, because an exertion should be made to understand, this is suffering here. An exertion should be made to understand, this is the way leading to suffering. In other words, an exertion should be made to understand these Four Noble Truths. So this then leads us straight into the Four Noble Truths. So now we're going to have a quick look at those, because they are kind of the background through which everything else is practiced. So, and then this next sutta is the famous sutta of the setting in motion of the wheel of the Dhamma, the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana Sutta. And this is, according to the story of Buddhism, it's the first sutta taught by the Buddha. So because it is the first one, obviously it has some significance. It's like the Buddha setting out his view of the world and his view of the Dhamma. It is interesting that when you look at the history of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, it exists in a large number of versions. It exists in a large number of versions in translation into Chinese. It exists in Tibetan versions and Sanskrit versions and Pali, of course. And when you compare them, they're actually, in many ways, they are quite structured quite differently. And in the Pali version, it looks like the whole sutta is spoken on one occasion. You get the middle way, the Four Noble Truths, everything kind of spoken on one occasion. But according to some of these other versions, this actually happened over a period of time. Yeah. And I think that that is actually probably more likely to be the correct way that actually these things would have happened when the Buddha started out. Because you can't present all of this stuff straight away to people. It would have been too much. Many of the things that we see here are technical terms. Terms that nobody would have understood unless the Buddha had explained them first. Yeah? It seems sensible that there would have been some time sequence here before, between the various events that is happening in Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And actually, Venerable Anālaya has made some very interesting studies about these things. Most of his studies are available online. He has very kindly made everything available. And basically shows that, first of all, the Buddha is likely to have taught the middle way. First of all, the middle way. And then once that was established, and his listeners, the five ascetics, once they accepted that, that is when you then moved on to the Four Noble Truths and the kind of bigger picture of things. Anyway, it's a bit of a side issue. But it's interesting that the suttas are, you know, sometimes they are not literally, everything is not literally exactly as it looks in the suttas. Sometimes we have to look at them with from different angles, in a comparative perspective and all these kind of things. But the main message, of course, is the teaching. And the teaching is pretty much the same across the board. But even there are some slight differences. But I don't think that anything that is really significant. So we can have a look at this. So, this is how it goes. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus of the group of five thus. So, just to give you a little bit of background here. So first of all, we have the standard opening of the suttas, thus have I heard. And what that signifies, it signifies that this is an oral tradition. It is passed down from one generation to the next one. So each generation hears these teachings. And it is in contrast, the contrast here between with thus have I heard is something that you have heard in the presence of somebody. When you have heard something in the presence of somebody, you don't say, thus have I heard. If it's in the presence of somebody, you say, Samukka me suttang, I heard in the presence of so-and-so. That is usually what is used then. So there's a different, slightly different ways of phrasing things. So this shows us that this is an oral tradition. And this is kind of the purpose of that very first statement there. This time the Buddha was dwelling at Varanasi. This is Benares, right? Also known as Varanasi. The deer park at Isipatana. Isipatana means, literally, it means the fall of the sage. Isi is a sage, it's like a rishi, right? Same word as rishi in Sanskrit. Patana means like the falling of the sages. So it has some kind of a connection to sages and wise people, basically, this particular place. And this now, of course, happened very soon after the awakening of the Buddha. The Buddha awakened at Bodh Gaya, and after awakening there, he was thinking to himself, now who should I first teach in the world? who are the people who will be able to understand this teaching that I've awakened to her? And then he thinks first of all about his first teachers that were Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, who had taught him previously, but they have already passed away, so he can't teach them. And then he thinks about the 5 monks, and these 5 monks were the ascetics who were looking after him while he was driving here. Yeah, and it's kind of sweet, isn't it? Here is the Buddha, just awakened to the highest truth, and that humanity can awaken to her. And straight away he thinks with a kind of gratitude, now who were the people who helped me? These 5 ascetics helped me. Okay, now is my turn to help them in return for the kind work they did for me here. Yeah, isn't that kind of, it's kind of nice. Yeah, so it's very kind of humane in one way, straight away. He doesn't just think, yeah, okay, who is going to awaken quickly, but also about who he actually has almost like a debt of gratitude to, in a sense. So this is where, this is why this is addressed to this group of 5, because they were his companions for such a long time before his awakening. And then we get this famous teaching on the 2 extremes, and this is what he says to the monks. Because these 2 extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What 2? The pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of the worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. And 2, the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge or insight, to awakening and to extinguishment. Yeah, so this is this famous middle way that the Buddha starts off teaching straight away. And why does it start with this? What is the point of starting with a middle way? And again, if you know a little bit about the history of what happened with the Buddha when he was striving towards awakening, you would know that he was doing all these self-mortification practices, right? What is self-mortification? Basically means self-torture. That's what it means. He was torturing the body. The idea being that if you torture the body enough, then somehow the spirit or the essence or whatever maybe gets released from the tortured body. Something like that. The idea is that by torturing the body, you gain some kind of spiritual breakthrough. They've been doing that for years, and the 5 ascetics who were supporting him, they also believed in self-mortification. Atta Kilamatanu Yoga is the Pali word. It literally means something like the pursuit of tiring yourself. That's quite literally what it means. So he had been doing this, and of course everybody in India at that time, they believed in this. This is one of the main practices. You look at the Jains were really heavily into this, and the Jains that existed prior to the Buddha, it is quite clear from the suttas. This was a standard way of practice, and people would praise it. Yeah, look at these arahants, they're practicing self-mortification. Arahants was a general word for people who had gone a long way on the path, who were serious spiritual practitioners. And so the Buddha had to explain to them, first of all, actually, this is the wrong way. You got it all wrong. I know everybody kind of thinks this is great, but actually, it was all wrong. So he has to kind of put things in perspective, because it goes so much against the grain of how the spiritual practice was done in those days. And it's very fascinating. You look at the kind of history of religion around the world, and you see this idea of self-mortification. It pops up in almost all religions. You find it to some degree in Christianity, you find it in Islam. It's kind of, it seems to be, the body is evil, right? I guess because of, the desires, the kind of carnal desires, all of these kind of things. So the body is bad, and it kind of leads us to attachment to the world. So by flogging the body, or by torturing ourselves, we're going against those desires, like you're neutralizing the desires, like causing pain instead. Something like that seems to be the theory behind that. And by neutralizing these things, then somehow we gain a release from all this physical and carnal problems. But of course it doesn't really work, because instead of neutralizing it, you're going to the other extreme, and you're just creating a problem of the exact opposite kind. And that's why it doesn't work. And of course the Buddha, he had also practiced the opposite thing, right? While he was living in the home life, he had a very luxurious upbringing. He wasn't a prince or anything like that, which is what is said in the later Buddhist literature. But he had a very luxurious upbringing here. And we'll have a look at that later on, how this is described in the suttas. So he already had tried that. He had tried the self-mortification. And then he realized neither of these work. These are two extremes. Is there a third way? Is there another way to awaken in here? Yeah, and this is a very famous passage, which is really very beautifully put. You find it in the Mahasatchika Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 36. And in the sutta, the Buddha says, is there another way? This doesn't work. That doesn't work. Is there another way? And then he reflects back to the time when he was a child. He was sitting under the rose apple tree here. And as he was sitting there, he spontaneously went into a jhana state. And then he reflects back on it. Yes, this is the way to awakening here. Yeah, the jhanas, this is the way to awakening here. And of course, the jhanas, they are the outcome of the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. They are the very last factor on the Noble Eightfold Path. So the whole purpose of the Noble Eightfold Path is to get you to those samadhi experiences called the jhanas. But those in turn can take you to the full awakening. That is the path, that is the way to awakening here. And that is why the Noble Eightfold Path is the middle way here. So this is how, roughly, what this is about. Yeah? So let's look at this in slightly more more detail. So the first one here is the sensual happiness in sensual pleasures. So the operative word here, if you like, or the important word here, is that this idea of sensuality. And the Pali word for that is kama. Not kamma. Kamma is one word. Kama is another word. You have to keep these words clear, keep them distinct. So kamma is action. Kama is sensuality. Slightly different words. This word kama is a very interesting word in Pali because it has really two different meanings. And it's important to be clear about these two different meanings. One meaning of kama, it means sensuality in the sense of sensual desire. Yeah, so if you have a desire for something, oh, the food looks really nice. Look at this beautiful porridge that is made by Danny. Danny, are you here? He's not here, okay. He's missing out. Oh, we're praising his porridge, okay. Oh, well, we'll do it later on. So, whoa, this beautiful porridge in the morning, yeah? And that is kind of the personal sense of desire in regard to sensual pleasures. And that is only one side of karma. The other side of karma is all the objects of sensual pleasure in the world. All the things that we actually like, yeah? All the beautiful sights, the beautiful sounds, the beautiful touches. That is the other side. And the word karma refers to both of those things. The personal sensual desire and also the objects of the world that we actually do desire. So what this means here, when it says here the pursuit of sensual happiness, what it means is the pursuit of sensory or sense happiness in the sense objects of the world. Yeah, that is really what it is referring to. Otherwise, the whole thing is a bit mysterious. The pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures, not entirely clear what that means, but it refers to pursuing happiness in the senses in the sensory objects of the world. Yeah, that is what it refers to. And this refers to all five senses. Yeah, so anything you get through the five senses that you are really keen on and is really happy, yay, oh, let's go and enjoy ourselves. And that is what it refers to. And then you have these adjectives that describe this. The first one being low. Low in Pali is hina. And hina is the same word as hinayana. Yeah, so hinayana is really a term of a derogative term for a certain part of Buddhism. The hinayana literally means the low or the inferior vehicle. And this is what it means here. Here it definitely means inferior or low. And the idea is not that sensual pleasures are bad as such. The idea is that they are a lower kind of happiness. There is on the Buddhist path, and this is one of the reasons why sensual pleasures can be given up, because there is something better. Yeah, if there's something better, why not give it up? It's fine. If there's something better, sure, no problems, we'll give it up. And this is really the point here. You have the hina, and then you have the panita. The panita is the opposite, but there's like the sublime. And the sublime happinesses are the happiness that come through the spiritual practice, so especially when you come to samadhi and these profound states on the of meditation, etc. So that is the idea of hina. Then we have the word vulgar here, which I think is an unfortunate translation, because the word vulgar these days tend to mean something that is coarse and unrefined and that sort of stuff. The original meaning of the vulgar just means of the ordinary people. That's what it means. The Pali word behind this is gamma, and gamma literally means relating to the village. So relating to the village, of course, means common, ordinary. This as the ordinary happinesses, the common practice happinesses. That is what this is about. The way of the worldling is putujanika, is the putujana, putujana. Putujana is the many folk, the many person. Putu is many, jana is person. So again, referring to the ordinary people. Worldling he has here. Worldling is kind of a strange word, isn't it? Worldlings? I'm not sure. Anyway, so the worldlings, ignoble, it is an area, not relating to the noble ones, the noble people. Unbeneficial, it doesn't lead to happiness, doesn't lead to anything positive in the world, doesn't lead to less suffering, often it leads to more suffering if you pursue this kind of happiness. So that is the idea here of sensual happiness. And then you have the opposite, which is the tormenting and the torturing of the body, the self-mortification, and which is painful. Yeah, we all know that, that's pretty obvious. And it is, again, it is ignoble. Yeah, it is not related to the noble ones. So that is kind of nice to remember that. If you torture yourself too much, basically it is an ignoble practice. So we know straight away there's something severely wrong with that. And it is unbeneficial. It doesn't actually lead to anything. And this is one of the reasons why I personally, and this is just really also following the way that my own teachers have taught, is the idea that you don't pursue pain in the body. You don't sit too long with pain in the body. A little bit of pain is inevitable, of course. You cannot sit even for 1 hour without any kind of pain whatsoever. It's impossible. But the problem is that there comes a point when the pain becomes very obsessive, and the mind goes back to the pain. You can't really deal with it properly, and it's a serious problem. And that is the time to change your posture, to sit on a chair, to lie down, or whatever it takes to feel comfortable again. Yeah, and it's taken from this very idea of the middle one here. And it's amazing how we forget even these basic things sometimes. And we go down the road and we accept teaching that sitting with pain for long periods of time is actually a good thing to do. I don't think so. And I think it goes directly against the Buddhist teaching straight away at such a basic level. So that is the problem. And of course, as I was saying, the very first day is that the reason why both of these things are a problem is because both of them relate to the body. If you feel happiness through the body, if you feel happiness through the five senses, the mind is going to go there. Yeah, the mind is going to crave and desire in that area. You're going to have attachments to that world. If you know that you're going to find happiness there, there's going to be attachments there. If you have pain in the body, it's exactly the same thing. If you have pain in the body, the mind is going to go there, because the mind is going to crave and desire to eliminate the pain and eliminate the problems. So these two things that are extremes and are opposite, actually the problem is that they are quite closely related to each other. And that is that you have business to do with the body as long as you either find pleasure there or you have suffering there. In either way, the body is important. But to be able to let go of the body and to focus on the mind instead, and to let go of the five senses, which are very closely related to the body, the only way to do that is then to go this middle path where you forget about those two extremes, and then the body becomes irrelevant. The five senses become irrelevant. If there's no pain there, if there's no happiness there, it doesn't matter anymore. It's kind of whatever. Forget about those five senses. And then you can go inside, then you can watch the breath, then you can allow yourself to calm down and become peaceful and all these kinds of things. Because there's no business in the world of the five senses anymore. And this is the whole point, to get rid of that business. And you will see that in your own meditation, how that actually works. And as you do that, of course, there's still a little bit of business because the mind is still involved in that world. But the first thing is to withdraw to that extent. So this is how that works. So in some ways, it is not really a middle way, you could argue. In some ways, it is just a way that goes away from the senses and away from the body. Yeah, so it is really kind of, in one way, it's a one-sided way. But on the other hand, we can also see why it is called the middle way. It sort of makes sense as well, because it is with the body disappearing in this way here. So that is what those two extremes are all about, and that is what the problem is there. And one of the important things here, of course, is the idea that if you find happiness in the world of the five senses, as long as you have that, you attach to that world. And then when you try to go inside, you try to let go, because you are attached. You can't really let go. That is the very point of attachment. Attachment holds you onto that world. So when you try to let go, you sit down and you try to let go of the body, you try to be peaceful. It doesn't really work. You only go so far. And it's like you come to a block. Yeah. You become so peaceful and you can't go any further. And very often the reason why you can't go any further is that you have some attachment to the world of the five senses, some attachment to the body. The mind won't allow you to let go because the attachment is holding you back. And very often you can't even see that because it is such a fundamental part of your psychology, of who you are as a person. It's actually very hard to see that you are still attached in that area. Yeah, and this is what stops you. So it is very interesting. There is this the mind. On the one hand, if you are attached to external things, you cannot go. You cannot let go. And this is why you cannot have it both ways on this path. You can't both indulge in the world of the five senses on the one hand, because that leads to attachment in that world, and you cannot have profound samadhi at the same time, because they move in different directions. One is an inward movement of letting go. The other one is an outward movement of attaching. And at some point, you have to choose which one you're gonna go for. So often you hear people say, "Oh, I want both. I want the happiness of the world, and I want the good meditation." Okay, you can have that to some extent, but only to some extent. And there comes a point where you're going to have to make a choice for which way you're going to go. Okay, so that is these two extremes. And then we have the middle way, right? Which again leads to all of these things, very similar to what we were talking about before. It gives rise to vision, gives rise to knowledge. Vision and knowledge is a jnana dasana, very kind of very well-known term in the Pali Suttas. It means knowledge and vision means insight, basically. But often it refers to deep insights. Yata bhuta nanadasana, seeing things according to reality. Yeah, and then of course all of these other things that come arise from the practice of this middle way. And what is that middle way? And surprise, surprise, it is the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right mind, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. The Noble Eightfold Path. And we're going to have a long look at the Noble Eightfold Path later on, by way of the gradual training, as I have already kind of let on. So I'm not going to say too much about this right now. The only thing I will just say is that the Noble Eightfold Path always starts out with right view. You have to have some right idea about the nature of existence. If you have got no clue about about the nature of existence, or how to look at the world, you're not even going to get started with these things, right? Why are you going to meditate? Why are you going to be kind? Why are you going to practice all of these things unless you think that there is a reason for that? You have to think that there is a reason. And that, of course, is what right view is all about. So everybody here, you already got right view to some extent, unless you have come here to torture yourself, in which case you have got wrong view. But if you are here because you understand that there is some happiness, some benefit to be had through spiritual practice, then you already, at least to some extent, starting off with right view. What does right view lead to? It leads to a change in our outlook, our change in how we live our lives, a change in our aim, and a change in our pursuits, in our purpose in life. our purpose become different, because we understand that actually happiness, satisfaction, contentment, lack of suffering is to be found in a very different place than what we thought originally. So our aim changes, yeah? And this is what kind of starting out on the spiritual path is all about. Different aim, different purpose. It is often called right intention, but I actually prefer the translation right aim myself, because it makes it more clear to me what is actually going on there. So from right view comes right aim. And then once you have right aim, then of course you start practicing, yeah? So you start practicing morality, right speech, right action, right livelihood. It begins with that. Once you have purified those basic aspects of morality, you go into right effort. Right effort is all about purification of the mind, yeah? So the mind gets purified. You start off with the coarser aspects of morality. You move on to the refined ones, which is what right effort is about. Then you have right mindfulness, which is what all about meditation practice. Anapanasati, Satipatthana, all of that is right mindfulness. And what that is about is removing the final upakilesa, the final corruptions of the mind, and bringing the mind to samadhi. And that is why the last factor is then samma samadhi itself, which is right stillness, if you like. So that is how the path, basically how the path works. And then it all leads up to right stillness at the very end. One of the important things about the Noble Eightfold Path, as I was saying yesterday about the five spiritual faculties, is that there is a natural sequence on the spiritual path. Yeah? These things, there's one thing leading to the next one, stage by stage. It is not just eight factors kind of put randomly together. This is a stage-wise process together, starting with right view, ending up with samma-samadhi, right stillness at the end. Very interesting that the path ends up with samma-samadhi. It doesn't end up with wisdom or anything like that. And the reason for that is because when you get to the right samadhi, the rest is pretty much just happens naturally. If you already have a right view at the beginning, and you combine right view with the right stillness, and those two things together is sufficient for the outcome to happen by itself. And that is why it says here that this Eightfold Path, it leads to all of these things. It leads to Nibbana. It leads to enlightenment, to awakening. You practice those things, and then the outcome sort of happens more or less automatically on that basis. So, there you are. That is the middle way. So we haven't even started with the Four Noble Truths yet. So we have a quick look at the Four Noble Truths. I don't think we need to say too much about the Four Noble Truths now. So, this is what the Buddha says. Now, this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, old age is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. Separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. I'm sure you can probably relate straight away to most of these things, why these things are suffering. It's not that hard to understand. Still, it is good to contemplate them a little bit, because as you contemplate it, of course, it sinks in much, much further. But what is interesting here, of course, is the idea that birth is suffering. Why does the Buddha say that birth is suffering? What's the kind of the point of that? It kind of seems we've already been born, so it's already done with, it's kind of finished with. What is actually the purpose here? And this is one of those areas, the only reason why, how this actually makes any sense to talk about birth in this context, is because of rebirth. It's going to happen again in the future. The birth in this life is already finished. It doesn't make any sense to talk about the elimination of suffering for something that has already happened. The only reason why birth makes any sense in this particular context is because it refers to rebirth. That is the only birth we can eliminate. That is the only suffering we can eliminate in that particular area. Yeah, so right here at the very beginning, the idea of rebirth is also part of the Four Noble Truths. And actually, I'm going to show you in a second, the idea of rebirth goes through all the Four Noble Truths, from the first one all the way down to the last one. And why is birth suffering? And of course, it is suffering in many ways because it is a start of a new life. It is a start of all the problems that kind of come with life, depending, of course, where you get reborn. Certain births are worse than others and all of these kind of things. One of the nice things that I often thought about, that is way of thinking about why birth is suffering here. You may have, probably, some of you may have heard about this ideas of near-death experiences. The idea that you kind of go out, you leave your body for a while, and you kind of look at the world in a different way. It's almost like you die for a while, and then you come back again to the body later on. And one of the very common aspects of a near-death experience is a sense of elation, a sense of liberation from a heavy burden. Getting out of your body, it's just so nice. It's so freeing. And then when you get told by some kind of spirit, now it's time to go back into your body again, you say, please, no, I don't want to go back into that body. I'm so happy being out of this body. It was one very famous example of that. It was an American lady who had an aneurysm in the brain, some blood accumulation in the brain. And it had to be taken out because if it wasn't taken out, it would burst. And then, of course, if aneurysm bursts in the brain, you are dead very, very quickly. And the only way they could get this blood out of her brain was to cool the body down to about 17 degrees or something like that, really, really cold. And then open her up and kind of take the blood out of the brain and then put her back together again. And while all of this happened, she had this out-of-body experience, like a near-death experience or whatever you want to call it. Then, as the operation was coming to an end, she kind of felt this force dragging her back into the body again. And she said later on, it was like coming back into a refrigerator. My body was so cold, 17 degrees, so drawn back into this refrigerator. She had no desire at all to go back into that terrible body again. Painful, cold, and all of these kind of things. So, what is the point I'm trying to make? The point I'm trying to make is that when you get reborn, it is the opposite experience, right? Now, when you die, actually death is a wonderful thing because you usually get rid of the body. The older you are, the more decrepit the body is, the more sick it is, the more wonderful it is to leave this all behind. And feel, wow, freedom from all this. Death is wonderful. And people get it completely the wrong way around. Especially if you have lived well, and you know that you're moving on to a good destination in the future. Whoa, it's so beautiful. So happy to die. But then, of course, if you're so happy to die, rebirth is bad. And this is kind of the point here, So you're going to get reborn, you're going to get trapped into a new body. Kind of, especially imagine if you are, somebody has just got pregnant, right, and you're going to get kind of into somebody's womb. And then, as you do that, this tiny little body, this recently fertilized egg, this tiny little few cells or whatever, you're going to get trapped into that, and stuck there for a long time, and eventually get born and all of these kind of things. So it's the reverse. Death is actually largely, I think it's underestimated how beautiful death can be. And it's overestimated massively how wonderful birth is. Right? The birth of a child was the most wonderful experience in the world. Actually, it's a really bad experience. Let's say this is Buddhism. Buddhism is really radical. It turns everything upside down. So this is why birth is right there in the First Noble Truth, and why, one reason why I think it is considered suffering, because it is this arising in a new life, and it is kind of negative. If you think I'm a bit weird, then that's okay, you're allowed to think that, that's fine. But it's just funny to look at things in a different way, because we have a tendency to see things from one angle, whereas there are often different angles as well to see these things from. Okay, old age is suffering. I think we all know what that means. But I think it's also useful to reflect on that, sometimes to go and see old people in the hospital or see them at home or whatever it is, and to realize how difficult it is to get old, especially when you get really old. You're towards maybe the last few months of your life. You become completely dependent on the care of others and all of these kind of things. Everything is breaking down, right? You can't walk, you can't see, you can't do anything. And perhaps you have dementia on top of all of that. Oh, it is such a really, really difficult. And it's good to reflect a little bit on that, because to remind yourself that every one of us, we have that nature. It's inside of us, waiting to come out, old age, right now. and to remember these things, because it gives you a bit of an oomph to move in the right direction. I'll talk more about that later on. Illness and suffering, right. So of course you can kind of understand that fairly straight away. Again, look at some people who have some really severe illnesses, like cancer, and look at what they look like after having cancer for a few years, especially serious cancers like lung cancer or whatever it is. You get completely emaciated. There's nothing left of you hardly. There's the skeleton lying in the bed, pretty much waiting to die. And that is illness for you when it gets very serious. And of course, death is suffering. Death is suffering for so many reasons, because often when people die, they die in pain. On top of the fact that you die in pain, you have all these attachments that you have to let go of at the very last point. And you can't let go, right? You know that you're going to have to leave this world, and you're clinging on. You don't really want to go, and you're forced to let go. You're forced to leave all of these things behind that are so dear to you. And this is what is so hard with dying. You are there, stuck on this bed. You know you're going to die. You can't let go. And you see this with people who aren't ready to die. They cling on, and they attach, and they fight to stay alive. And it's a terrible, you can see the suffering that is going on at that particular point. But of course, by practicing the spiritual path, you learn to let go of the things of this world and then move on instead into the new life with much more ease and happiness. And this is kind of the importance of this. But it's worthwhile looking at that, because it is a very painful and very distressing thing to see when somebody is desperately trying to hold on to this life, when they know that the end really has arrived. So this is why death is so can be so very distressing and difficult. Then we have the union with what is displeasing, right? All the negative stuff that we have to experience in life, all the negative words that people say to us, all the people we have to hang out with that we don't really want to hang out with, all of the things that happen that are basically displeasing. That's what that is about. And there is a lot. And not only is there a lot, it is unavoidable. You cannot live a life and avoid all the problems. You can't avoid bad speech coming your way. You can't entirely avoid people who are unfriendly and who are nasty and who are difficult. These things are part and parcel of being alive. So union with what is displeasing is what you have to expect. And this is, of course, the problem of this. It is a natural part of life. Separation from what is pleasing, exactly the same thing. Things get taken away from you. Your husband or wife, your boyfriend and girlfriend find out they had enough of you, that they leave you behind or whatever. And endless things that are always separation from the pleasing. Again, this is also another unavoidable reality of life. Not to get what you want, right? Are you surprised when you don't get what you want? You have to expect that. It is part and parcel of life. And then, in summary, and this is the last one here, in summary, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. And of course, that is what they call Buddhist hybrid English, is what they call that. Nobody in ordinary English ever talks about the aggregates subject to clinging. It's a very kind of artificial way of talking about things. So what you could maybe say the five aspects of personality, that are subject to clinging, or something like that. Something aggregate to me means a pile of sand or a pile of gravel. That's what it means in English. If you have a gravel, it means kind of aggregates. Here it, of course, is used in a different way, but it's still slightly artificial and slightly strange. So the five aspects of personality, this is the five khandhas. And of course, the five khandhas are the most important places in life where we have a sense of self. And this is why these things are pulled out in this specific way, because this is where what we identify with. This is the real me in these five khandhas. So these are suffering. And this is the most profound way in which the idea of suffering is explained in the suttas. And the only way you can understand this is through insight. You have to have an insight to be able to understand why the five khandhas are suffering. Because if you fully understand that, it means that everything that you take to be yourself, everything you identify with, in the final analysis, it is a problem. Yeah, and of course we can't really see that, because sometimes we're happy, sometimes we suffer, sometimes it's neutral. So what is the big issue? Well, this is what I mean. It needs insight to see these things. And that is what this is really about. This last thing here, it is the understanding that this whole thing is really a problem. And we move away from the five khandhas and we give up our sense of identity with those things. Only then is it really possible to overcome suffering completely and absolutely. Okay, so I'm going to stop there because I've already gone a little bit over time. So we will continue, of course, this afternoon at 3 o'clock. So in the meantime, have a nice lunch and keep on enjoying yourself. And we'll see you again at 3 o'clock.